This is the Formation Lab.
Welcome one, welcome all to a Fergulous podcast episode of the Formation Lab. Is Fergulous a word? No, but it also describes how Tim and I are feeling after a wonderful... All right, I take that back. After a race weekend. Of all the race weekends, Tim, this was one of them.
It certainly was one of them. It whelmed.
It did well. You know,
it went. I'll be honest, half of it had me in my feels, I think is what the kids call it. Feeling very, very nostalgic and very sad. And then the other half, I was just trying to keep my eyeballs awake. I'd had an entire pot of Death Wish coffee and nothing could save that thing. And then there was the other race, which was, I'll call it predictable.
Yeah. Yeah, it was predictable. So what should we neither even talk of us, about first?
Even though neither of us picked the winner. I think last week I went for Dixon. Who'd you go for again?
Yep. And I believe who did Grant go for? I think Grant went for Newgarden.
I think Grant did go for Newgarden. I went for Dixon, and I can't remember who you went for.
I think I did go with Willpower though.
Did you? You went with a safe bet?
I think I took the least hot take, but hey, congratulations to Willpower. What a cool story.
Yes.
Albeit not in the most spectacular ending race in Laguna Seca, but, congrats to Willpower. What a spectacular story it is for him at his age to come back and win a championship in the second championship right there.
Well, he does have an anger and a fury the size of men half his age. So yeah, that makes sense to me.
You know, he's got one championship for each time he flipped for each bird that he flipped at the race stewards in New Hampshire in 2011.
That was a deep cuts callback. And number one, I'm here for it. I love that. Keep doing that every time. And two, he is now the two-time IndyCar champion. Congratulations to him. It was a season of just remaining consistent.
Season of consistency. That's the beauty of IndyCar is you don't really need to win many races to win the championship. You just got to be in and out in the hunt for a lot of races. And that's what Willpower did. He just realized, hey, all I got to do is be in the hunt. Finishes P3 right behind Joseph Newgarden, Alex Plow, two very talented drivers in their own right. Joseph Newgarden, multiple time champion as well. Just knew what he had to do, went out there, got the job done. And again, a testament to coming back and fighting back to relevancy. If I'm being honest with you, not that I think he was washed up, but I didn't think that he was a championship driver maybe 2 years ago.
I kind of fancied him like I did Kimi Raikkonen, where mm-hmm. he could get fighty when he needed to, but he wasn't the Kimi of old. I agree. I didn't think it was the Will of old, but he showed some real flashes this year. And I think a refinement in his approach to his racecraft. He seemed a lot more patient in portions and in spots where even last year, I would have expected him to come out swinging like at Nashville and last year for the inaugural race. You know, there were a couple moments where I thought Will was going to come out of his seat and kill somebody. Yes. I didn't really see that much fire from him this year. So he dialed back the temperature a bit and he played the long game. So, you know, good for him. I'm thrilled for him.
If you're curious, by the way, dear listener, last time he finished in the top three in points was 2018. And in 19 and 20, he finished fifth in the points. And in 2021, he finished ninth in the points. I think the ninth last year was an underserve. But going into this year, if you told me Willpower was going to be a championship, I would have said no. I probably would have told you somewhere around fifth in the points, to be 100% honest with you. And again, his last time he won the championship, 2014 as well. 8 years, if I'm doing my math. Yes, 8 years between championships for a man like that. That's a mighty resurgence. I'm looking back too. I forgot that in 2010, 2011, 2012, three consecutive second place finishes, by the way. So Willpower joins elite company, all-time pole wins, the all-time pole sitter championship in IndyCar, champion in IndyCar history, 230 races now, two-time champion, 85 podiums, 68 poles, 41 wins, and two IndyCar champions. Just a big old congratulations to a monstrous career. And to be honest with you, he rode the back of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 third place finishes, right? In St. Pete, the Indy 500.
Unerringly consistent.
Yeah. If he has truly chilled out, so to speak, or at least he just sees that
I don't know why
better in that place.
Maybe I don't know why, and I might be completely wrong, but I just did not see the, you know, swing for the jawline willpower much this year. He was a little fiery, sure.
I agree.
But you know, I think that many third places, that's a calmer head. That is a guy who's like, you know, I'm seasoned. I should be out here trying things a little different because the way I'm going ain't working. And he did it. He pulled it off, you know, in the pantheon of greats, he will now be among them.
Yeah. And here's a fun stat, by the way. Outside of his rookie season, this ties Will's all-time low of only one win in a season.
And again, it comes back to that consistency with IndyCar and indeed with Formula One. I mean, George Russell is the one you point to there. How many races has he gotten between third and fifth?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just insane. And in IndyCar, that's clearly what makes you champion. Yeah. Only one win this year. He didn't do it with flash. He did it like a smart guy.
I think if that mature Will truly is upon us, I don't see any reason why he can't run that back in the next couple of years.
Oh, there's no reason he wouldn't be able to. I mean, that it's a whole new game and guys are going to be clued into it a little bit more, but that, I mean, to get third that many times and to win a driver's championship on only one win throughout the entire season, that's an art form. So willpower has gone from not good at it at all to artist. And I don't think other drivers are going to be able to bridge that gap. I think that really speaks to Will's ability as a driver to completely change the hardest part about the driver, which is the head.
It speaks to me, the ultimate IndyCar champion of the modern age, which is Scott Dixon, right? Like the prototypical, what you need to do to be an IndyCar champion is be Scott Dixon. And when I say that, I mean, look at Will Power's first five races, third place in St. Pete, fourth in Texas, fourth in Long Beach, fourth in Alabama, third at the Indy 500. That's a Dixon-esque run right there.
That is Dixon. But again, it's, you know, Dixon was a little flashier this year. He still was there though. You know, he was right there with Will Power. He may have had a little bit more inconsistency, but doggone, that consistency wins championships.
Consistency really does. I think that's why I love watching it, I love watching those IndyCar championships play out, is because that consistency really does. It really does feel like, regardless of team, Will Power was the most consistently good driver this year. And not saying that like a Max doesn't feel like he's the most consistently good driver, but you can be like, oh, well, you know, where's the challenger? It's like, no, you look at the three best drivers in IndyCar this year in terms of just raw consistently being incredible on the track. Power, Newgarden, Dixon.
Yep.
I'll tell you, man, I can't argue that those shouldn't be the top three. Whereas you take a look at the F1 championship right now and you're like, oh yeah, obviously Max Verstappen is in the lead, but who is the third best driver? And are they really third best in the championship this year?
And how far back are they? Because George Russell isn't that far off the points. You know, all things considered with the dog that is that car. You know, I do think that anyway, that this is neither here nor there, but Lewis Hamilton's performance with it is an indicator to the performance drop off. You know, he was driving at the peak of the last car. He's driving at the peak of this car and it's just not there. And George Russell is getting every ounce out of it. Which is just deeply impressive.
I should mention too that third place was at Indianapolis Motor Speedway, not the Indy 500. I might have said that the wrong way. Will Power probably would have locked that up if you didn't finish 15th in your inaugural Indy 500, by the way, Tim.
Sorry, Will, that was my bad.
Tim, I do have to ask, we asked that a while back ago, your first Indy 500, how was that experience?
Borderline religious, if I'm honest with you. It was this seething cauldron of happy people. You know, from every different walk of life, you know, it didn't matter your politics. It didn't matter, you know, your race, religion, or creed. Everybody was just there to enjoy the race. People were, you know, giving each other food, giving each other water. You know, everybody was talking racing. It was crazy. I wore a McLaren F1 shirt, and I was getting compliments left and right, you know, and everybody was complimenting, being like, hey, that's really cool. Remember way back when? And it felt to me kind of like opening day a little bit at the at Busch Stadium with the St. Louis Cardinals. It's weird that we relate this particular experience to the listeners who are decidedly international, but I'll try to describe it to you where our hometown, St. Louis, is deeply ingrained on a society level with our baseball team, the St. Louis Cardinals. It is a true blend of everyone in the city whenever we all go to watch the ball game. You know, obviously the green seats and the ritzy people are, you know, there's still some societal barriers, but for more or less, you know, the bleachers are the best spot to sit. Anywhere is good. Anyone's going to talk to you, buy you a beer. It felt a lot like opening day where there was an electricity, now, albeit at the 500, that electricity was magnified 100 times. Felt a lot like that vibe going through, though, where there's this uplifting, hopeful, hey, we're all here now, we're home again. And you know, we can all share in this little thing that's ours, this little piece of the world that we have that entertains us. I think it was deeply fun in that way.
I'll say this, and it probably sounds ridiculous to people who haven't been, but two things. One, when they see you back home again in Indiana, when you finally return there for like the second time, it really does, like, the track feels like home again. Like, you're like, okay, this is where I'm supposed to be in the universe right now.
It was absolutely bizarre, but it was the first time I'd been there. And when they sang that song, I felt like I'd been there all my life.
Right. You're like, gosh, dang it. I do have pride in, I do have Hoosier pride in me, which means
I know. I genuinely didn't see that coming. It was cool.
The other thing is, it is almost a religious experience in that, like, I've never been to the Sistine Chapel, but I've heard stories when people walk into the Sistine Chapel, like, it doesn't matter what you're from, you know, what you believe in, your creed, your race, you're just like, you get these goosebumps where you're just like, oh my gosh, this is a deeply special place. You know, it moves you. That's what Indianapolis Motor Speedway is for me as a race fan. And I think for a lot of people, it's just like, you realize very quickly that you're walking onto a very unique place on earth where just the ground itself is different, you know?
Yeah, it really is like super trippy. You just feel differently there. So yeah, my first experience was both, you know, completely out of body experience and also very, very comfortable. It was just a nice place to be. And I didn't feel in any way crazy or out like a stranger or anything other than just me. So it was really nice. And I just had a blast. The race itself was fantastic. We had
we
had a great view of the track for the whole day. I will repeat again for the listeners at home. Dylan planned the whole trip. Super producer Dylan holy cow, he did everything almost down to like the minute marker. And on the drive home, he decided to race God and try to see if he could make it there before the sun actually set, because Dylan,
it's Dylan.
It's Dylan. He has to entertain himself somehow. But it was a ruthless schedule that he had us on. It was awesome. We, you know, everything down to the minute, you know, and I was just like, yeah, cool. Just point. I'll go. It was great. It was a crazy time. We were there. We enjoyed it. We watched the Monaco Grand Prix in the stands. And then we watched, obviously the Indy 500 in person, because I usually curse this decision, but for the first time ever, I was very happy to be a Spectrum Mobile customer, because everybody at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway had AT&T, but I didn't. I had a different network, and I was able to get on, and I was streaming 4K on my phone, and you know, we were watching, being like, oh wow, look at the rain in Monaco. That's a little crazy. You know, you can really see it hit the wets, and it was just a really cool view. So yeah, in that moment I was a wise man, and I had a great reception. So we watched that, watched the race, and we hauled out of there.
So speaking of magical tracks, kind of went on this tangent. I knew where I was going to segue out. We raced in Monza, the best Italy track. No offense, Imola, but please do take offense, Imola.
I was going to say, yeah, no, yeah, yes, offense, Imola. Come on, no.
I don't hate Imola. I just, if you're going to have two races in a country, you should be a little further apart and better tracks than, or more entertaining than Imola.
Agreed. Definitely agreed. But Monza, the last few years, has produced electric racing. We saw the win from Pierre Gasly in 2020, which was just a mind-blowing moment. It was such a cool story, and it was so bizarre because it was 2020, and, you know, nothing was open, everything was shut down. So to see Pierre Gasly up there in the confetti and the champagne, and he's all alone to bask in this cool moment where he completely redeemed himself from his complete disgrace from the Red Bull seat. And it was this redemptive, cool moment in the season, followed very closely by 2021, when not only was the top step occupied by Daniel Ricciardo, but Daniel Ricciardo sporting the racing suit of McLaren, who hadn't had a team win in almost a decade. Since the Ron Dennis era. And next to him was Lando Norris, also with McLaren. So it was a McLaren 1-2. And Daniel Ricciardo redeeming himself from, you know, from making the jump from Red Bull to Renault, now to McLaren, and very much being on the back foot the whole season, getting shellacked up and down the circuit by his compatriot Lando Norris, who ultimately would oust him. I personally feel that Lando's bludgeoning of Daniel Ricciardo forced them to cut ties with him, because it's just like, this is embarrassing. You know, but that one moment, that one race at Monza, the cathedral of speed, the Italian heartbeat of Formula One. And then we had this year.
It's going to be like, so Tim, what magical moment happened this year?
Oh, no. Well, I could get poetic, but I won't, because it was lame. This was a race that occurred, you know, much to no one's surprise, Ferrari bungled the pit strategy. And then, Max took the win, which he was, what was he leading by, like 20 or 30 seconds or something crazy like that? It was 20, 30 seconds right up until the final crash, which was not a crash. It was Daniel Ricciardo's engine failing, and he parked up on the side of the road. There was a crane on the track, which always, ever since, I mean, and I've gone on ad nauseum about, you know, how I feel about them running drivers on the track, you know, with a crane on it, you know, ever since his death, Jules Bianchi back in 2013. Why did that take me so long? Good Lord. I apologize, everyone. It's the end of a Tuesday. I did a lot of public speaking today, and it's been a very hard work day, so I'm a little brain dead. But Jules Bianchi back in 2013, when he ran into the back of the crane and it decapitated him.
Yeah.
Seeing
why
that
do we
is,
keep making this mistake? I don't know. Feel like we should have learned this lesson the first time, but
how hard can it be? There's a crane, stop the cars. Like, you don't know if something just fluke will happen, and that they are in danger. What is wrong with you?
Yeah.
But that kept on for like 10 laps. And I texted you in the middle of it. I think I texted the group chat.
Yep.
Saying like, oh, this is done. Cause the FIA, the new race stewards, are going to obey the book, which says if there is an obstruction on the track, you keep going under safety car. And if it ends, it ends, which is how 2021 Abu Dhabi should have ended. And my poetic point would have been, wow, it's nice that the FIA finally decided to follow their own rules. Michael Massey.
There was a great picture of Lewis Hamilton in the background looking at Max, who was like just smiling. And I believe it was on Formula Dink, and the caption was just like, wow, winning a race under safety car must be nice.
Yeah. And it's, you know,
so I don't have any issue with that. If you want to red flag that race, you can red flag that race. IndyCar does have a bit of a precedence doing that in their bigger races to red flag it to preserve it, but it's not the precedent here. But I don't, if you want to do it, do it. I mean, it, the good thing is that they didn't just launch into green for no reason whatsoever. Or they didn't have to break their own rules to launch into green. I don't know what else to add. I mean, look, Ferrari probably, they went with an alternate pit strategy here. I don't think it made a difference, Tim. I mean, they could talk all they want about like, oh, you know, it might have cost Charles Leclerc the win there. And it's like, no, it didn't. Did you see the Red Bull?
Yeah, the Red Bull was very strong. And would Charles have been able to compete a little bit more? Probably, if they hadn't pitted him twice in the first 20 laps. But at the end of the day, the Red Bull was just stronger. There's no two ways about it. And
there's no stopping the Red Bull this year.
No, not this year. So I think that's the rest of your 2022 season, if I'm terribly honest with you. I don't see that pattern breaking anytime soon. Max is too ruthless and that Red Bull's too good.
Yeah, it's... And hats off to Red Bull for building an absolute rocket where a lot of other teams have fumbled, and they're running. I mean, outside of some reliability issues early on, they're running as reliable, as clean of a championship run as you can really do anymore. But there's nothing there. George Russell takes on P3. I kind of want to talk about our P9 guy.
Let's.
So first off, let's give credit where credit's due and wish Alex Albon all the best on his recovery. Last second appendicitis.
That poor kid, I swear. He has had more bad luck. If it weren't for bad luck, he'd have no luck at all. He is now the official patron. His patron saint is Albert King. That's all I'm gonna say. That is brutal, but in walked his replacement, backup driver, reserve driver for Williams, one Nick DeVries.
Nick DeVries, by the way, all right, 27 years old, so well past the scope of getting an F1 deal
Way. I know that Toto Wolff has really, really pushed for him to get that Williams seat, and then Albon eventually got it. So this was kind of a redemptive moment, or maybe a vengeance moment for Nick DeVries. Yeah. But yes, he is well past his prime to be getting a top tier drive. To give you reference, he is how many years older than Max Verstappen?
Oh my gosh, 3, 4, 5,
something crazy like that. Yeah. So anyway,
so Nick DeVries has been been in Formula E for a few years. All right. We'll see. Debut season 2019, 2020. Right. And he's done all right. He won the championship last year in Formula E. He comes in to a Williams car that he has tested, but he has not raced. And this is an important distinction. And he only went and put it on the points, baby. P9 for deeply, a P9.
Deeply impressive. Deeply impressive. And the call, I think my favorite part about it, though, was in Parc Fermé afterward, when he parked the car and said, so can someone come help me get out of the car? Because my arms aren't working anymore. Yeah. They actually had to come lift him out of the car. He could not physically move anymore. So it speaks to the torment that goes on in that cockpit. But I also think that I think that comes with a not enough upper body strength from Formula One drivers. Yeah. You know, if they had to deal with, I don't know, not power steering, they might be a little bit stronger, a little bit, I don't know, better able to handle those kind of pressures for an extended period of time.
Yeah, it speaks to the talent that he has, but also I do think that it raises some interesting questions in, I don't think any driver, any person that's qualified to talk about the difficulty of respective series is going to tell you that Formula E is a harder series to be in than IndyCar. I don't think anybody who seriously watches those two would tell you that. I can see people saying, like, you know, Formula E isn't an easy series, and I'm not saying that it is, but I'm not saying that, like, you know, most of the Formula E field is not going to go into IndyCar and whoop up, we'll say, right?
Correct.
So Nyck de Vries comes through. Your champion from last year, and he's been a pretty consistent runner, finishing P9 this year in the championship, albeit, you know, with an asterisk. He comes through and puts it in the points, and I just don't see how you can argue that IndyCar does not prepare someone for Formula One when Formula E very clearly gives you a driver that is least as good, if not better than, a couple guys on the grid, specifically the Gotifi.
The Gotifi is who I had in mind as well as the son of a clothing magnate. So
be real with me. Do you think Yuki Tsunoda would have put it on P9?
No, absolutely not. Too angry. He would have probably cut someone out, broken his steering wheel, and gone off in a huff. I think the case against Colton Herta getting his super license point is incredibly weak, and just outright cowardice on their part, because IndyCar absolutely prepares you for Formula One. It should absolutely be a transferable license point. So I think what they've done is prejudicial.
I think they kind of backed themselves into a corner here, because reportedly Nyck de Vries is getting some looks from other teams. And it's like, well, if Nyck de Vries is, I don't see
how Colton Herta couldn't be. And it's from Colton Alpine, Herta, but.
Or to be honest, half the top end of the IndyCar field, the top 10 in IndyCar.
Yeah.
The only person I could see is maybe, like, I don't know, Will Power could do that. I think Justin Newgarden could. Scott Dixon, no question. Scott Dixon would get a podium out of it.
Yeah, he would.
Not off of raw pace, but off of, like, capitalizing on the chaos of the moment.
Lap one is just Dixon territory. He'll gobble you up.
Scott Dixon would be like, lap what was it, that one crash in Mugello in 2020? Scott Dixon would enter that race last and somehow find his way on the podium because he got through that entire multi-car collision scot-free.
I mean, because he's Scotty Dixon.
He's Scotty Dixon.
He is not good enough for Formula One, apparently.
McLaughlin would McLaughlin might have a shot. McLaughlin still would. McLaughlin's still learning the open wheelers. Pillow would. I'm not sure.
Pato would.
Felix, don't think so.
Romain Grosjean, we've already answered that question.
Right. I don't think Graham Rahal would. Rossi wouldn't. not current Rossi,
not Marco Andretti either.
Yeah, right. But there are five or six guys that I think
I would say that, yeah, there are solid five or six guys who do tremendous.
Yeah.
But that is sadly something that we're just an L we're just going to have to take, which I think is criminal.
I do too. I do think though that it's fun to watch the IndyCar Twitter offseason IndyCar Twitter. It's gone back to one cohesive family in IndyCar, in that literally every IndyCar driver is rooting for Colton Herta to get that seat because they're just sitting there like, this is ridiculous. Alex Rossi, who I don't think has super friendly relationships with Colton Herta as a teammate. I don't think they're like rivals, but I don't think they see eye to eye on a lot of times. Alex Rossi is like, this is bullshit.
Yeah.
Oh man.
It's making enemies out of, yeah, it is coalescing everybody into one big happy IndyCar family. So well done, FIA. Super proud of you. I'm glad that you like the Americans to, you know, pump money into your sport, but you know,
don't want us to drive though. Don't want us to drive.
Exactly. Thanks for putting a real fine point on you don't want us to compete. Yeah. Sorry to say, we're coming for you.
Sooner or later. I like the message that Grant Palmer sent me the other day. He's like, Nicholas Latifi is playing the long con. All right. He doesn't want points because he wants to avoid having to pay the FIA any more money based on the points that he gets.
Can you audibly hear my eyes rolling at that?
Yeah, I could hear the little
the little rattle
noise. Yeah. Who has the cheapest FIA super license on the grid? Oh, that's one, Nicholas Gotifi. Thank you.
Really, saving, he's being Williams economical. Money. Economical. Yeah,
he's a very economical driver.
His daddy perfect pumps in all the money, and his performance doesn't cost you any more money. So good. Yes. All of it.
Do you reckon that he saved the team money on the super licenses versus crashing?
Yeah, he made up for it, didn't he?
Yeah, he probably did.
I mean, yeah, he's like, well, I saved you license points, so here's a wrecked car. It's in bits. Take these bits and do something with them.
So Aston Martin, yikers this weekend, the ninth fastest car in qualifying. Vettel and Stroll both failed to get into Q2.
Yeah, owie. That's I don't think there's a good way up right now for Aston Martin, and the fact that Fernando Alonso is going there just does nothing but break my heart, because they aren't going anywhere anytime soon unless they copy the Red Bull car, which they're not above doing. We've seen them try. I don't see any good way out. Martin Whitmarsh is now involved with, so given his presiding over the downfall of McLaren, I don't anticipate he's going to be very effective or do anything beyond make it worse at Aston Martin. So now that I've just publicly shellacked a revered official of F1, I think that's my thought.
I don't know what quite to say to Aston Martin, except for one of the premier, are they doing a disservice to the brand of Aston Martin and what it once was? Does Aston Martin have the DB9 fridge anymore?
I don't know that, you know, Aston Martin, I think, had this, kind of this nostalgic rose water glasses kind of feeling in everybody's minds, but were they actually that good? I think the best part about Aston Martins is how they look. They're aesthetically very, very pleasing.
Yeah.
But that's it. You know, there's not a whole lot else they do. They're very heavy. They're very expensive. They look sexy as shit. There's no other way about it. No other way to describe it. And, you know, it's the Bond car. They have brilliant marketing. They had some good racing years, but not enough to justify this level of nostalgia from the British public and indeed the world. But the world got into it because of Bond. So I don't know how much damage this actually does to their brand as much as the damage to Lawrence Stroll's pride, which is a far more egregious error. So I'd say his pride getting knocked is going to be an unforgivable sin that he's going to lay holy waste to.
Yeah. Was it Casino Royale that they drove a Ford in? I think, hold on. I gotta go down. Hold on. You mentioned he's the Bond car. And I'm like, I think Casino Royale, if I remember right, there's an uproar because he drove a Ford Focus or something like that. Let's see. Hold on.
James Bond.
Casino Ford Royale.
Focus.
They drove a truck in that.
Spectre, a Ford Mondeo Skyfall. In Casino Royale.
Yeah, Ford Mondeo.
So like you're gonna hate on the Fusion? My God, you guys.
Has Aston Martin built a Bond car or have they built a Ford Mondeo?
Well, the modern day Ford Mondeo does look shockingly like an Aston Martin. Go Google it, 2022 Ford Fusion or Ford Mondeo if they're still making it across the pond. That looks like a dead ringer for an Aston Martin.
That does kind of look, I'm seeing it in that Aston Martin green almost.
Yep.
When I Google it.
And with a neon stripe down the side. Don't lie and say that you didn't see it. It's there. And the thing is, they've been doing that thing since 2012 is when they first rolled out with it.
Yeah.
So like, Ford leaned hard into that marketing. That is how intense the Bond marketing is with Aston Martin. If you look even a little bit like an Aston Martin, you sell like hotcakes. No one's ever going to touch you. So Ford, the behemoth, leaned into it.
So the other big story in Formula One is that reportedly, and this broke while I was flying to US 131 Motorsports Park in Michigan, reportedly Porsche is out of Red Bull. Apparently the way I understand it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, Tim, is that Porsche believed originally Porsche is just going to make the engines. And as time went on more and more, Porsche wanted an even 50-50 split and maybe even primary ownership of the Red Bull Technologies, Red Bull Racing. And Red Bull would be stupid to sell a majority of their racing team. And they just kind of called the whole thing off. So now we're looking at Audi and no Red Bull, or Audi and no Porsche in upcoming seasons.
So as I understand it, and there have been like five or six stories, depending on who you talk to, I kind of see it in my mind how I really wanted it to go was exactly how it went with an old man named Enzo who in Ferrari country in Italy and Modena, I believe, he met with a team of attorneys and they laid out a contract to buy his company, Ferrari. And they would have taken over all racing operations for Ferrari. This particular buyer, Ferrari, legendarily, with his fountain pen filled with purple ink, circled the whole paragraph and in the margins wrote, "This is no good." And he then, as James May put it, in that particular Grand Tour episode, he then turned to his local town lawyer, said, "Let's go get a bite to eat," went to lunch and never came back. And that is how Ford failed to buy Ferrari.
Yep.
I see Christian Horner and Dietrich Mateschitz sitting in that room with the Volkswagen attorneys who said, "We're going to take over 50% of your racing operation." Because they would have rolled that out later. They would have said, "We'll do title sponsorship, we'll do your engine sponsorship, and we want to be 50-50. Because the image they released, if I'm not grievously mistaken, had Red Bull half and then Porsche half.
Yes.
And that's exactly what Porsche wanted, half. And Christian Horner and Dietrich Mateschitz circled it in their fountain pen ink and said, "This is no good." The thing is, Porsche, I don't know whether or not they were like not honest about that the entire time. Shit, the the renderings for the marketing were 50-50. So yeah. It's not like they weren't completely telegraphing everything they wanted. So apparently talks broke down and they did walk away from the deal. And now Porsche will not join Red Bull. That is not to say that Porsche will not be on the grid. It just won't be with the Red Bull family. Now, obviously for marketing purposes, that made a whole lot of sense. But they will find another way. It's Porsche.
It's Porsche. And especially if Audi's doing it, you know, Porsche will. But Volkswagen yeah. Automotive Group, of course, owns both. But every once in a while,
the biggest benefit to you and me, though,
yeah,
you and I benefited from this falling apart.
Yeah.
Because now Dylan's going to be honest about Red Bull again.
Yes.
He's no longer the number one dick rider.
Yeah, he will unheel turn and he'll be like, you know what? I have always been a fan of Haas Porsche.
That's exactly what he'll do. Hell, Haas will just be like, hey, you want the whole thing? Take it. Like, you don't even have to pay me. Take it.
I feel like Haas has to be almost profitable this year. Maybe they are straight up profitable this year.
Who knows?
Not they a got bad year for them.
Schumacher's paying for his seat. They're paying Magnussen for his seat. So,
but they're getting points. They're not in the turlet.
They are not in the turlet, but they're paying out more for those licensing points because Grant is counting the pennies.
Goodness gracious, he really is. I think the biggest loss for me will be those mock-ups for Red Bull Porsche, where it's just a black hot and red Red Bull car.
That was hot.
Gosh. Was,
but
we don't have any we don't have any black cars. And we haven't since
for
Lotus.
Good reason. Well, no, we had it with Renault. Renault was dominantly black 1 year.
That's true. Yep.
With yellow highlights. That being said, hot cars don't need black paint.
No.
Because that is absolutely going to heat up your car. I don't care what you say. You're out there on the tarmac in the blistering sun. You're going to suffer some temperature points in your engine bay for that. And that's just how it is.
Look, I just want them to look cool. All right. And I think murdered out stealth black looks cool.
Oh, I'm not disagreeing. It's hot as can be, but you know, unfortunately it does cost the team. So, you know, paint that baby something else. Oh, the other all black car that we've had for the last 2 years on the grid actually was the Mercedes.
Oh, yep. You're right. The Mercedes felt different in all black. I don't know. Mercedes looked better in all black to my opinion.
I just think
they're iconically silver, but I loved their black.
Yeah, the silver arrows are legendarily silver because they took off the paint because back in the day, the Germans didn't think that they needed to add the weight. But the cars this year for Mercedes look decidedly fighter pilot-esque, fighter jet, like from, or fighter plane from the World War II era. Yeah. It looks kind of like that. And I, you know, it's a turd. So,
well, I think the good news though is that if it went through, all right, this Red Bull, this Porsche buyout of Red Bull, if it went through, we would have seen a handcuffed Christian Horner attached to some kind of corporate structure. And Christian Horner and Red Bull have proven again and again that they're best when they're just left up to it. You know, that Christian Horner hasn't had any oversight from Red Bull itself in ages. Can you imagine him trying to play the Sierra a bit to bull role and report to Volkswagen Automotive Group? No.
That would have been poor.
Yeah.
Very poor.
I think in a way it's better for Red Bull that they're unporched.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad they didn't budge on that part. I think because then you really do run the risk of becoming that manufacturer brand. And we need privateers.
We do need privateers. I feel like we're seeing the death of privateers anymore, which we have. It's been a trend for 20, 30 years, but
now there are so few left. We have to preserve the ones that are still there. And I guess we're doing it by letting them just, you know, beat the shit out of the grid. So
Notice how we said we have to preserve the ones that are still here and not add new ones. Heaven forbid Andretti gets in. Oh,
yeah, gee, yeah. What a shame. Those dirty, dirty Americans. Give us their money. Nothing else.
What a shame.
We didn't take. Hey, guys, listen,
we didn't take 50%. We took the whole effing thing.
Yeah.
We're coming.
Yeah. Yeah. What makes you think that they can run a competent race team? All right. Their supercar team, their extreme E team, they know nothing about running a racing team except for their supercar team, their extreme E team, Formula E team, Indy Pro 2000 team, their Indy Lights team, their, of course, the IndyCar team as well. It, besides from those six teams, they know nothing about running a racing team, Tim.
No, not even a little bit. Yeah. So, yeah. But
and,
hey.
and besides Michael Andretti and Mario Andretti, they don't know anything about Formula One besides the two, you know, big head honchos there being former Formula One drivers. But other than that, they know nothing about Formula One.
No, not even a little bit. That's okay.
No. Tim, I don't know what else to talk about. It feels kind of light this week, but I mean, we kind of had, and I hate to say it, at least the race was relevant in IndyCar. We had two snoozers.
It was quite boring. We have, I think, stretched every single milliliter of content out of this weekend. So, yeah, no, I think that's it. And on to the next.
On to the next. Singapore coming up in coming up here soon. I love that track. I love that
I
race.
Love but Singapore.
I can only assume that it's going to be a Red Bull shellacking, and we'll be here to talk about it.
Yep, as always.
See ya.